Diverse authorities have speculated. Why is it that the common mass of people so adore the rotten, the awful, the trite? In a remote laboratory, two genuine warlocks, Ben R. Williams and Greg Morrison, will look popular taste dead in the eye and hold a scalpel to its bloated gullet. They will read America's most popular books. They will ridicule the New York Times bestseller list. They will destroy their reputations and follow a terrible book even into a rotting grave. This, good people, is cannon fodder.
I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer. I'm not a man. I'm a destroyer.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to episode 15 of Cannon Fodder. I am Ben R. Williams.
And I'm Greg Morrison.
And tonight we will be discussing Eat, Pray, Love by Elizabeth Gilbert. It's going to be a little bit different from usual. We hope you enjoy it. Now,
it's the wacky weather edition.
We've had... weather's been a thing that's happened.
It's been a blight on our land. And it's made ordinary podcasting habits very, very difficult. And, you know, also there was the Saturnalia that is late December and early January. So, you know, there was that too. And, Eat, Pray, Love, was an obstacle, I would say.
It was. And we'll get back into that shortly. First off, Greg, what have you been reading lately?
Well, I've been reading, getting back into the Virginia history, read some books about freed African-Americans in the latter half of the 19th century, Revolutionary War of Virginia. But I read a Margaret Atwood book.
Oh, yeah?
The Robber Bride, about a bunch of bitches, basically. she was mean. The book. But, yeah, actually not a whole lot of just sort of fun reading. I have a ton of books that I really, really want to read and that are tantalizing me. But, I've actually mainly been doing, research reading. Mm-hmm. Like, trying to track down details or firming up my grasp of things that I had read a long time ago and do not know as well now. What about you?
I recently read Roadside Picnic by the Strugatsky brothers.
Yeah, you told me about that.
Yeah, that is the book that there was a film based on it called Stalker in the late 70s, Russian film. Absolutely loved it.
Yeah?
Absolutely loved it. It was really good. Premise, aliens come to Earth. There are several landing sites. Then they immediately go back into space. They leave behind all kinds of weird stuff that people cannot understand nor explain. Hmm. And the metaphor used is though, you were to go on a roadside picnic and you were to leave behind, you know, a Coke bottle and some trash and, you know, a fork or something. What would ants think when they encountered these things, you know, these strange objects? What would it mean to them?
Hmm.
Sort of the same thing. And these people known as the stalkers who go into... these incredibly dangerous areas where all this space trash has been left and collect it to sell to the government and private bidders. And, it's for many years I'd been wondering if anyone had written the kind of science fiction that I had always wanted to read, and apparently it was coming out of Russia in the 70s.
So, oh, yeah?
Yeah, I think that, and I'm looking to get into some Stanislav Lem as well, based on... what I've heard of him, I think I would enjoy his style. Just a cold and unfeeling universe. That, aliens that, you know, they neither love you nor hate you. They just don't even know you exist.
Yeah, they're indifferent.
Leave behind devices that murder you. That's what I like. That's pretty aligns with my worldview. So that's one thing I read. But also, well, Eat, Pray, Love. Let's talk about that. Greg, what did you expect going into Eat, Pray, Love?
I thought I'd hate it.
Mm-hmm.
The reasons being that, I knew about this book before it was a movie, which, I mean, isn't much of an accomplishment. But You know, I remember thinking, yeah, we're both looking at the same cover right now. Mm-hmm. And it's got the pasta noodles on eat and the sort of prayer beads for pray. And then love appears to be the petals of a flower. And it just, it looked like that sort of faux homemade thing that you see on like a lot of lifestyle blogs. Or like kind of hipster homemade chic kind of things. You know, like, oh, it's so authentic and, you know, oh, I just made this little arrangement, you know, that kind of thing. And it just seemed like, well, this person's a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
And all of those things seemed self-indulgent and showy. And we'll get into that. But, and also just, you know, the three-verb stack. I thought it was going to be a memoir that chronicled, you know, somebody treating themselves and acting like they were discovering themselves.
Yeah. Well, I will confess, I knew nothing about this book going in. I was dimly aware that there was a Julia Roberts movie based on it.
Right.
Didn't know anything about it. Didn't know anything about Elizabeth Gilbert. So I really went in with no expectations.
Yeah.
And what I certainly did not expect was just how much I would hate it. To the point where, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not proud to say this. I'm not proud of this. I did not finish this book.
Hear, hear.
I could not finish this book.
Yeah.
I, you know, the spirit was willing, man, but I never before, you know, and we've read some really shitty books.
Yeah.
14 of them. And, you know, there was a moment where I had to kind of grapple with some things. I had to ask myself, you know, Ben, is it this book, or is it that you're just burned out? You've read 14 terrible books, and you just don't have it in you to do the cannon fodder anymore.
Mm.
There's a lot of soul searching.
Yeah,
I said, no, I just hate this book. I really hated it. And the best way, I thought about, you know, how can I explain why I hated it? And the best way is by way of telling a story.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever told you about this, but, I mean, it's not a huge revelation or anything. But,
I'm the Gill Man.
Yeah. I walk among you. So I was probably in middle school.
You know, yeah.
I had a really good friend, and his mom used to, she was big into interior decorating.
Okay.
And there was this lady in town who was a professional interior decorator. And because me and my buddy were inseparable, you
right.
know, sometimes he would get dragged along to see the interior decorator, and there am I too, you know, two peas in a pot. So young Ben hanging out with this interior decorator. And now, number one, you know, interior decorating, not a world I understand.
Right, sure.
Nor appreciate.
Don't like interiors. Don't like decorating.
No. I live in the woods. It's the only place that comforts me. And we would go in and she would start, this lady, this interior decorator, would start talking about the world of interior design. I mean, my friend's mom, she would like redesign her house like every 8 months to a really? Year, you know. Yeah, it was crazy. Had to stay modern. And so this lady would tell her about the newest styles.
Hmm.
And she would tell her about, you know, curtains. But they weren't curtains, they were window treatments.
Yeah.
And she would talk about these window treatments in the sort of way that, you know, she made it clear that if you didn't get the hip new window treatments, you were a grade A son of a bitch. And, you know, I couldn't get behind that, but there was something else. There was the way that she would turn a phrase, and even her voice, mm-hmm. just her actual, the sound of her voice, that I could not stand this woman. I couldn't stand her. I'm sure she's a sweet lady. You know, she never did anything to me. But I would have to walk out of the room when she came in. I would just have to leave because I would just had such a strong physical reaction of just, shut up. You know, I couldn't take it.
Well, and I should say that having known you mm-hmm. at this era, I think that I can safely say that you were probably one of the mildest and sweetest people that I have ever encountered at that age.
Yeah,
so the idea that you were physically sickened to the point of rage by someone, you know, it's probably pretty awful.
It's, yeah.
It's a little testimonial.
And, you know, and like I say, I mean, you know, I'm sure she was a sweet lady. You know, it's nothing against her, but it was just something about
just everything about her was repulsive.
To me. Yeah, no, it was a very personal thing.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, no one else, or at least not many people, had the same reaction. But that was how I felt reading this book. Yeah. Every word of Elizabeth Gilbert's I read. Shut up. and when I was trying to read it, you know, I got about 40 pages into it over 3 sittings. Every time I sat down to read it, like no other book I've ever read, my head was filled with thoughts of, you know, well, my time could be better spent doing anything. I never learned to play the harmonica. Why don't I go to a dairy and learn how milk is processed? Anything at all, better use of my time.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I apologize to the people, all 7 of you. I'm real sorry. I've let you down. I couldn't do it, man. I just couldn't.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, in all fairness, I got to say, the first time that we were talking about reading this, you know, I wasn't too keen. I mean, this is a big-name title. A lot of people know about it. It is, as the book testifies, a New York Times bestseller. It's a movie. Julia Roberts is in it. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of laughter.
Yeah, she's funny, right?
I remember reading it. I remember reading it in the parking lot. Like, I was sitting in my car, and I'd finished my teaching classes that day, and reading, you know, maybe like the first 15 pages, and I just had to put it down. Like, it was so insufferable. Just so tediously obnoxious. And, I mean, we can talk about what brute force of obnoxiousness might have revealed that. I know I have certain tales. I don't know if you wanted to...
Yeah, I've got a few. I call dibs on the first 40 pages. After that, it's a little spotty. Yeah, I can wing it and do the jazz thing, but... no, well...
Well, we should talk about the premise.
Yes.
Well, all right. Yeah. So I'll outline it quickly. So at the opening of the book, Elizabeth Gilbert, successful journalist, is distraught because her marriage is ending for reasons that are undisclosed. Those tapes are sealed. So anyway, her marriage is ending. She divorces her husband. She moves to Italy, like you do. And because she wants to learn Italian, she hangs out with a bunch of people in Italy and learns to speak Italian and just wanders around and does shit. Like, she doesn't have a job. She just hangs out in Italy. Buys a bunch of expensive food. Really expensive food. And she gains a bunch of weight. She talks about that at some length. Then she moves to an ashram in India. And she prays a whole bunch about shit.
And she got ashrammed. That's my contribution, ladies and gentlemen. A butt sex joke.
Did she get ashrammed?
Please continue, Craig.
Anyway, it's one of the few anal sex-based meditation programs. A lot of beads, a lot of lubricants, and... she also finds love. And she moves to Bali because at the beginning of the book, she meets, on a journalistic assignment, she meets this quote-unquote medicine man, a.k.a. tourist trap, who, and we'll talk about this, who, like, just sells her a load of bullshit about how unique a person she is. And she moves back to Bali. And in one of my favorite parts of the book, the least intended humor book, part of the book, rather. She moves back to Bali. Like, she completely reorients her life and moves to fucking Bali to go hang out with this medicine man who she doesn't know. And she goes back and talks to the medicine man because, you know, they had such a serious connection. And the medicine man's like, oh, who the hell are you? So she hangs out in Bali, and apparently it's awesome in Bali because, you know, you can be white and rich. And no worries.
Yeah.
She starts having sex with Felipe, who is basically like who's the Mexican beer man? You know what I'm talking about? The guy in the beer commercials?
Oh, sharpest guy around.
Yeah, yeah.
Smartest man, most interesting man in the world.
Yeah, is it Dos Equis? Or is it
it's Dos Equis.
Okay, all right, so Dos Equis man.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically who she's having sex with. That is her description of him. That he's just, he's from Portugal, and he's fascinating. And he kisses her ass a whole bunch. Which, having been ash-rammed, she certainly needed. Anyway, she eats a bunch, she examines herself, and then she has a lot of sex, and that's how she found peace. And that's the book.
God.
So...
Boy, sorry, I missed all that.
So let's go back to the opener. So she is in the process of losing her marriage right now.
Alright, well there's the first thing. So, you've got this whole book about, I've had this horrible event happen, the failure of my marriage.
Right.
That has caused me to feel the need to discover myself and go on this journey. But she won't explain why her marriage fell apart.
No.
She will talk at decent length about how awful her husband was. But then for reasons of propriety, she will not, specific things that her husband wanted in the divorce that she was not willing to give up. And she mentions, you know, that I guess they wanted to have kids, but she realized she didn't.
Right.
And so she drops occasional details, but she says, well, you know, I don't want to talk about my husband too much.
Yeah. It's my story.
It's my story. It's like, well, you've got the worst of both possible worlds because you have talked about your husband, but you haven't explained the situation.
Yeah.
And you steadfastly refuse to explain the situation that's the catalyst for the entire book.
Right. Well, there's an irony in writing a memoir and then saying, the reasons I didn't want to be this man's wife anymore are too personal and too sad to share here. It's like, well, it's a memoir. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? What you do is write the personal and sad details of your life, or else it's not really all that interesting.
It sort of reminds me of my favorite memoir, Everything's Coming Up, Leif Garrett, which, man, that guy's doing great. Have you heard? Have you read his book? It's bonkers. But yeah, you can't do that. You just can't do that.
Right.
I almost, immediately lost any sympathy for her when, within presumably minutes of leaving her husband, she starts dating this guy named David.
Yeah.
This beautiful, beautiful creature named David.
Well, I was going to quote this at some length. All right. So, they're talking about, how great the David time was, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was still my romantic dream hero, and I was still his living dream. It was excitement and compatibility like I'd never imagined. We invented our own language. We went on day trips and road trips. We hiked to the top of things, swam to the bottom of other things, planned the journeys across the world we would take together. We had more fun waiting in line together at the Department of Motor Vehicles than most couples have on their honeymoon. We gave each other the same nickname, so there would be no separation between us. We made goals, vows, promises, and dinner together. He read books to me, and he did my laundry. That's a little Oprah delivery.
Yeah, I like that. Well, I'm sure she loves this book.
Yeah, I think she actually endorsed this book.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to continue from that quote.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I'm going to go ahead and have a brief pause here to denote that this is the part of the podcast I might have to edit out. I want to read a fairly long section.
Okay.
Several paragraphs.
Sure.
So, things are great with David, the new boyfriend.
Right.
But then 9/11 happens. And, you know, maybe you guys didn't know this, but after 9/11, everything changed. And so too did Elizabeth Gilbert's relationship with her boy toy David.
We started wearing those weird hats. Yeah. It was weird.
Oh man, I forgot to pay my tithe to the Grand Imperator. I need to do that later. Anyway, I thought I had fallen to bits before, but now, in harmony with the apparent collapse of the entire world, my life really turned to smash. That's a phrase, apparently, turned to smash. That wasn't me misquoting. It says turned to smash. I wince now to think of what I imposed on David during those months we lived together right after 9/11 and my separation from my husband. Imagine his surprise to discover that the happiest, most confident woman he'd ever met was actually, when you got her alone, a murky hole of bottomless grief. Once again, I could not stop crying. This is when he started to retreat, and that's when I saw the other side of my passionate romantic hero, the David who was solitary as a castaway, cool to the touch, in need of more personal space than a herd of American bison. David's sudden emotional backstepping probably would have been a catastrophe for me, even under the best of circumstances, given that I am the planet's most affectionate life form, something like a cross between a golden retriever and a barnacle. But this was my very worst of circumstances. I was despondent and dependent, needing more care than an armful of premature infant triplets. His withdrawal only made me more needy, and my neediness only advanced his withdrawals, until soon he was retreating under fire of my weeping pleas of, "Where are you going? What happened to us?" Let me read you one more paragraph, okay. Continuing this theme. David and I continued to have our bouts of fun and compatibility during the days, but at night in his bed I became the only survivor of a nuclear winter as he visibly retreated from me more every day as though I were infectious. I came to fear nighttime like it was a torturer's cellar. I would lie there beside David's beautiful, inaccessible sleeping body, and I would spin into a panic of loneliness and meticulously detailed suicidal thoughts. Every part of my body pained me. I felt like I was some kind of primitive spring-loaded machine placed under far more tension than it had ever been built to sustain, about to blast apart at great danger to anyone standing nearby. I imagined my body parts flying off my torso in order to escape the volcanic core of unhappiness that had become me. Most mornings, David would wake to find me sleeping fitfully on the floor beside his bed, huddled on a pile of bathroom towels like a dog. "What happened now?" he would ask. "Another man thoroughly exhausted by me." Now, I realize that was a lot that I just laid on you guys, and I apologize for that, but I felt it was important to quote all of that.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
What were your thoughts when you read those sections, Greg?
A couple things.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, it's disingenuous to say, I can't talk about my divorce, but I can talk about this thing. I think what's really going on is she has a legal agreement with her husband to not disclose things.
Yeah, that's probably true.
I don't think it has anything to do with being dignified or whatever else, because she basically talks about how she ruins this guy's life. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I'm going to make a really tasteless joke. Mm-hmm. If I were a woman, I would not say that I was like a cross between a golden retriever and a barnacle. You know why, Ben?
Why is that?
Because I... All right, I'm going to say the...
Ash rammed!
I'm going to say this is the second thing, because you probably edited that part out when sober thoughts prevailed. But all right. So, you know, this is a very revealing simile, and I find that people's similes are revealing. Mm-hmm. She says that David is as distant as a castaway. Now, why are castaways isolatos, pray tell?
Well, they've been cast away.
They've been abandoned. Something. They've been shipwrecked. And I think that the thing that she does not acknowledge is that, well, I mean, she does acknowledge it. She says, like, well, you know, I was needy and I kept chasing after him. But she chased after him in a way that connoted only her patheticness, her patheticity. Mm-hmm. You know, like, she never approached him as an equal via her own description. I wish that she had made clear... Like, well, I was struggling with depression, I, you know, this, that, or the other. Maybe she could have acknowledged that it was not exactly a good idea to get in a desperately romantic relationship on the heels of her divorce, which apparently was a decade-plus relationship. You know, a lot of different things. There are a lot of unhealthy dynamics going on here. And the fact that rather than try and preserve the bond that she had with him, she would much rather reminisce about, like, oh, the things we had. Oh, remember when things were great. Oh, remember when we used to give each other nicknames. And it's like, well, if you're nostalgic for how your relationship used to be, then you basically have two options. You can either forget about what happened and be, like, excited about the future, or you can admit that you're nostalgic for something you'll never have back. You know, the right in the dead center of the Great Gatsby. You can't repeat the past, Mr. Gatsby. I'd say that's the biggest lesson of old Elizabeth Gilbert.
Well, I will take this in a similar direction. So, you know, I'm reading this, and I'm thinking, here is a character I'm supposed to not only like, but identify with.
Right.
Now, here's the thing. Every guy I know, alright?
Yeah, yeah.
Every, and, no, it's true. I don't want to sound misogynist.
I'm on this petition.
Alright. Every guy I know has had at least one, some as many as three or four relationships, where everything is going great. And smooth sailing, waters are clear, and suddenly your beloved starts acting strange.
Right.
Starts acting troubled. You know, oh, what's wrong? What's wrong, baby? Nothing. Nothing's wrong. So you think, oh, well, you know, maybe I'm not fulfilling my duties here. Maybe I should send her some flowers at work. Maybe I should try to fix things. Somehow that only makes it worse. And you realize very quickly that there's absolutely nothing you can do. It is the person you are in a relationship with has, for whatever reason, had some sort of bizarre emotional change that they cannot explain to you, but seemingly expect you to fix, even though you can't.
Right.
And it's like being asked to defuse a bomb from a state away with a blindfold on, your hands tied behind your back. You know, you're probably, your first order of business is calling a press conference to explain, hey, I'm really sorry about that explosion. You know, it's going to happen. It's just going to fall apart.
Right.
And I can't identify with this person because, you know, well, for reason.
Well, and I mean, to be fair, yeah, I mean, like, yes, exactly. Like I said, like, I would sign that petition. I remember actually a phone call, not to get too real on this podcast. I remember very clearly standing in the gardening section of Walmart and having a conversation with you on the phone. Mm-hmm. And you and me talking about this very dilemma. And you described it as the Kobayashi Maru of relationships. That there's no way to win. You don't win.
Yeah.
The best you can do is hope to fail gracefully. The reason why both situations are galling, okay, is that I think that the best books provide a kind of profound intimacy. And there's a cheap intimacy that is the tell-all memoir. And there is a much more profound intimacy where, like, I don't know all that much. I don't really want to know all that much about the biographies of many authors that I've read and whose books I've loved. I don't know shit about Ford Madox Ford, for instance.
I don't even know who the fuck he is. We're in good shape. Hell with him, man.
I know a very little bit about Vladimir Nabokov. I don't know much about, you know, all these other authors that I've loved and really, really enjoyed. But I don't need to, because the testament of their lives is in fictional works that are made up. And their invented worlds are so much more honest and so much more profound than this person's snide confessional. And that's the difference between a person who looks at you in a relationship and says, like, oh my God, I'm just, like, so upset. I don't even know what to do, and it's all your fault. But somehow it's not. I'm just really upset. I guess I'm leaving you now. Versus, you know, hey, I'm kind of having a bad time. I'm just going to admit it. Mm. All right, let's figure it out.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a fundamental lack of honesty.
Yes.
And that is the thing that has bothered me. I was going to say this, just categorically. That is the thing that bothers me about all memoirs. And actually, there's a relevant Edgar Allan Poe quote about this. Poe said that, you know, like in the middle of the 19th century, there are all these narratives and, you know, testaments and, you know, talking about, like, this is what happened to me. And he said it was impossible. And he said that, you know, the only, like, if someone were to write a book called, you know, My Heart Laid Bare, that the pen would catch fire and the pages would burn instantly. Because it was just, it was impossible to write that. And the only way to get that kind of fugitive truth on paper, and Melville said the same thing, that truth is like a doe scampering through the woods and you can only glimpse it by bits and pieces, is through fiction and through creative act. And not through just, you know, let me traipse through the hall of memory.
Well, and that was the other thing that bothered me tremendously. There seems to be a movement in a lot of literature right now. Of course, this book came out, you know, several years ago, but I mean, it's been
last
going
decade.
On for a while.
Yeah.
There's no story so interesting as my story.
Right.
Everybody wants to tell their story. And
right.
Somehow their story is going to have, you know, all the details that will illuminate your own life. Well, the problem with Eat, Pray, Love is that if you want to undergo the journey of exploration, self-exploration that Elizabeth Gilbert goes through, step one, be loaded.
Yeah.
Have a lot of money, because that's going to cost you. I don't know, maybe... Maybe I'm not part of that 1%, but it seems to me, it's topical still, right? It seems to me that I can't just traipse off to Italy for a month and spend vast amounts of money and then go to two other countries.
Right.
Know?
Well, that was the thing that was bothersome to me, is that as a writer, as somebody who has spent the better part of the last month, you know, writing at least like 1,000 words every day because I desperately want to finish a novel. I mean, it's very frustrating to read about somebody who is a writer, has room in her life, by her own admission, to write. She has, quote-unquote, a home in the Hudson Valley, an apartment in Manhattan, 8 phone lines. What do you need 8 phone lines for? What does that even mean? How do you have 8 phone lines?
That's how she got so rich. She's a drug dealer, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, do you have, like, just 3 phones in each house and they have different phone lines? Like, what does that even mean? And yet, I think that it is just a fundamental lack in herself. And I think that perhaps there are some people who... you know, if you raise them up by money, then like they arrive at a certain plateau and it's like, oh man, well, I have a bunch of money and, well, this is weird. You know, I'm not doing everything I wanted to do. It's like, well, yeah, you didn't know what you wanted to do to begin with. And it is very, very frustrating to read about this person who lives a life of absurdly decadent privilege. I mean, if she had taken the money that she spent on this however long odyssey of you know, farting around the world, if what she had done is gone to like a meditation center or a monastery, because there are monasteries all over the Eastern Seaboard where you can retreat. Let's say she went to a monastery, and instead of spending all this money on herself, she gave that money to a foundation. Let's just say.
Well, but then, Greg, would she have found herself
at the bottom of an empty wallet?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the frustrating thing. And it, you know, and actually I was talking to a woman who had read this book. And I said, you know, like, look, I mean, I'm a man, lady, and Ben's a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, we're both gentlemen. But on the other hand, you know, you're a woman. Like, is there something different that you think this appeals about to women? And she said no. And that, in fact, she thought it was insulting that the first step to a woman letting go and, like, discovering herself was to eat a bunch. Like, oh, I'm so frat.
Yeah, I got some Haagen-Dazs because yeah. The boyfriend... Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. The basically, the trip to Italy is a prolonged night with Sleepless in Seattle and a bowl of ice cream.
Yeah.
It just plays on, like, the worst and most superficial tendencies in pop culture right now.
I will point out another thing that bothered me about this book, which is... you know, obviously praise right in the middle of the title. There's
right.
a lot of the relationship with God. And Elizabeth Gilbert hopes to strengthen her relationship with God. She says that she's not strictly a Christian because she believes that Christ isn't the only way towards an understanding of God. So she talks to the ninth generation Balinese mystic and all, who's a con artist, apparently.
Plainly.
Yeah. And saw her coming from a mile away. Yeah. Yeah. Rich white lady, this will be an easy sell.
Exactly.
But her approach to God is, I'm not a religious person.
Right.
By any stretch of the imagination. If you've listened to all 15 episodes, this should be abundantly clear. But I have a lot of respect for people who are religious people, and I think that, you know, that can be a wonderful thing and a very deep thing. And when I see somebody approach God as a combination between an electric blanket and an antidepressant, I think, well, you're not doing it right.
Right.
For Elizabeth Gilbert, God is a magical being who exists to comfort her.
Yeah.
And to make her feel better about herself.
Yeah.
You know, don't ask what you can do for God. Ask what God can do for you. You know, make that fellow work in your favor.
Yeah.
And I find that offensive. I think that it's a very, this new agey sort of thing that you see a lot. And, you know, you hear people say all the time, like, well, you know, my religious beliefs, I just can't pick and choose. You know,
right.
I have my own sort of things. Well, that's not how it works, man. You know?
Yeah. Well,
have some strength of convictions for
crying out loud. You know, the frustrating thing about that is that, and I think the most telling thing about her, you know, dark night of the soul, because she admits that. I think that she is very typical of our time. I would say, I think that despite the fact that she is at least, you know, what, this book was written 2006, when she was 36. So she was born in 1970. She's about 15 years older than us. I would still say that within, in terms of like the cultural moment, she's probably within our generation. And I think that the whole sort of reflexive, self-critical examination that she does a lot, like she'll be in the middle of some sort of profound religious experience. And she'd be like, now look, I'm not saying I'm St. Francis of Assisi, but on the other hand, saw God.
Yeah.
And, you know, the great thing about St. Francis of Assisi and about, you know, Teresa of Avila and people like that is that they didn't do a whole bunch of apologizing. They're just like, holy shit, I saw God. And I just would like somebody who forthrightly said, you know, I had a really profound experience and it took me to the very limits of my understanding. And so I, through my writing, am going to take you to those same limits. She does none of that.
No.
You can easily, psychologically, never leave the comfort of your armchair and pat yourself on the back for having accompanied her on this experience. Which is why it's probably a bestseller.
Yeah, that's probably accurate.
And fuck you people who like this, apparently.
Yeah, well... But I went to a college with a lot of Gilbert, so I will say that. You know, maybe that's part of the problem, is I know Elizabeth Gilbert. I've seen her many forms. And... all of them have been a pain in my ass in some usually academic setting.
Well, the thing is that, you know, all right, for instance, she divides her book into 108 sections, I guess. Mm-hmm. She says, you know, it's, oh, there's 108 beads on the prayer string and, you know, all this stuff. And that means there's 36 tales in each section, which is convenient because this is my 36th year. And I think that's very typical of her.
Yeah.
That I think a religious person would bow down in silence before something momentous, you know, a momentous coincidence, what Carl Jung called synchronicity, the meaningful coincidence. Whereas Elizabeth Gilbert makes a kind of dumb pun out of it. And at the end, every pun is a pun on the fact that it relates to her. The entire universe revolves around her. God himself, which she says that she refers to God as a he throughout, and she wants to. God, whatever you might call God, the shadow of the turning, speaks in Elizabeth Gilbert's voice to her. And this book is not so much about accepting the universe or accepting some sort of wheel of the law that rolls throughout all of our lives. This is a book about Elizabeth Gilbert accepting Elizabeth Gilbert. And I don't know why you need to bring thousands of years of meditation and, you know, insight into psychology into that tortured and ultimately unspoken quest. She spent a lot of money. She indulged herself a lot. I'm sure she felt better about herself after treating herself for several years on end. I mean, I don't know how else to interpret that.
You know, while I was reading it, the thought crossed my mind that, you know, she said that she was asked, you know, would you like to meet a ninth generation Balinese mystic? And she said something cutesy to the effect of, you know, with bells on, yeah, I'll be there. Yeah. It just occurred to me, I wonder if people in Bali think like, yeah, I get to meet a primitive Baptist minister. Yeah. Oh. Let me pack the suitcase. Yeah. I think it's a uniquely American thing. And that was the other thing. I need to learn Italian. Better go to Italy. Yeah, well, there's no way to learn Italian in this country.
Yeah, that's one thing we actually haven't talked about all that much, is this sort of cheap cultural tourism quality of this book. I mean, okay, let's just take as a hypothetical example. Let's say that this book were called, you know, Eat and Pray and then Love Him. And it was, because I don't know those words in German. Let's say.
Yeah, my German vocabulary is strangely limited on just those three words, too. That's weird.
I mean, let's say that, like, you're from Middle Europe. And I say this because German speakers are apparently the predominant sex tourists of Southeast Asia. Let's say that you wrote a book and you're a middle-aged German sex tourist. And it's all about how you left your wife for reasons that you can't explain. So what you did was you went to Vienna and you ate a ton of sausage. You just ate your fucking face off. Then you went to Thailand and had sex with a bunch of preteens. Then you went to Bali and had some more sex with some preteens. I mean,
Hog 2, Electric Boogaloo.
I mean, that is a catastrophic example, and I know this is probably all in bad taste. And I know that I'm probably taking somebody whose intentions are good and all that sort of stuff. But the principle is exploitative. Mm. The reason why Elizabeth Gilbert feels more authentic and romantic in Italy, like she says, is because she is naively romantic about Italy. She says that. And she talks about her Italian language class, where there's all these people from around the world, and they're like, oh, I wanted to feel sexy again, so I decided to learn Italian. What the fuck does that have to do with anything? Yeah. There's plenty of ugly people who don't have sex who know tons of Italian. And there's many fine sonnets that have been written about that. And I just, I don't understand the idea that that sex, bravery, and joy are located either in a poor and very foreign country or in the past. Like, oh man, medieval times. What would that have been like? Or, oh, you know what would have been great is if we lived in the antebellum South. You know what I mean? That, yeah. Like, this kind of, it's either nostalgia or it is a displaced nostalgia onto a third world country. Mm-hmm. This belief that, like, oh, if only I could just tour this fantasia world. It's like, well, no. Everyone has to adapt to circumstances that they're born into and find meaning and joy in that life.
Or, if they can't, maybe it just means they're creatively bankrupt and don't have any original thoughts.
Have nothing to say about anything.
Well, on that note, Greg, would you recommend this book?
Well, I was going to ask you, Ben. Mm-hmm. There's two poems that she wrote in the ashram.
Really?
And they're free verse. They're free verse. They're not too long. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you maybe would split the duties with me.
Yes, what page is that?
I would say probably 210, 211. It's at the end of the ashram section, so section 72. There you go.
There they are.
Okay, would you like to read the first one or the second one? Which one do you think?
I'll take the second one. You start.
Okay. Two poems from an ashram in India. This is the first one. This is before she finished her ashram program. all this talk of nectar and bliss is starting to piss me off. I don't know about you, my friend, but my path to God ain't no sweet waft of incense. It's a cat set loose in a pigeon pen, and I'm the cat. But also them who yell like hell when they get pinned. My path to God is a workers' uprising. Won't be peace till they unionize. Their picket is so fearsome the National Guard won't go near them. My path was beaten unconscious before me by a small brown man I never got to see, who chased God through India, shin-deep in mud, barefoot and famined, malarial blood, sleeping in doorways, under bridges, a hobo. Which is short for homeward bound, you know. And he chases me now, saying, got it yet, Liz? What homeward means, what bound really is.
Poem the second. However, if they'd let me wear pants made out of the fresh-mown grass from this place, I'd do it. If they'd let me make out with every single eucalyptus tree in Ganesha's grove, I swear, I'd do it. I've sweated out dew these days, worked out the dregs, rubbed my chin on tree bark, mistaking it for my master's leg. I can't get far enough in. If they'd let me eat the soil of this place, served on a bed of birds' nests, I'd finish only half my plate, then sleep all night on the rest. Pretty heavy.
So anyway, to answer your question, No, I wouldn't recommend this book at all. No, I wouldn't recommend it.
You know, I'd go so far as to say I don't recommend reading. It's fraught with danger. Nah, man, I can't, you know. I feel like it's not fair for me to render a verdict based on the fact that I didn't finish it. But, yeah, I've read enough. I wouldn't.
Well, I would say, as my substitute pick, I would recommend, and I hope I haven't recommended this already, a book called Salvation on Sand Mountain. It's about snake handlers. Yeah. And it's about snake handlers in Alabama and Mississippi and in southern Appalachia. And I think that nothing will make you tremble at the thought of religious faith more than that book. Because those people in that book are all decent people. They're all kind people and all that sort of stuff. But, and I mean, they're all poor and very, very simple people. But they have a kind of elemental understanding of faith that makes them do things that other people just don't understand. And, yeah, I'd recommend that.
I'll go with, the same vein. Good Country People by Flannery O'Connor.
Mm.
Yeah, no particular reason. I just really like that story. It's real good. Check it out. 4 stars.
It's good stuff. No free verse in it.
So what's the next book we're reading, Greg?
Well, you know, Ben, it's a Milgram surprise. it's a little psychology reference for you.
Milgram's Progress.
It's, you know, what we like to do on Cannon Fodder, and one thing that I think has been the hallmark of our work on Cannon Fodder from the get-go, is we love holidays.
Oh, shit, I thought you were going to say quality. Thank God. Yeah, holidays. Yeah, that's
holidays,
correct.
You know, the calendar, Saints' Days, whatnot. One holiday coming up pretty soon, St. Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
Boom. In your face, holidays. I think that it would be unfair to mention what our title is. And instead, I think that we should just let our faithful listeners know, that you, buddy.
Hey, Mitch.
You're going to hear a podcast about a real romantic title. And it's going to be pretty soft and sensual and slow. There's going to be some Al Green, maybe some Barry White.
Maybe some Ash Rams.
But only if you're ready. Only if you're ready. We don't have to Ash Ram tonight. It's really not a big deal.
Baby, come on. It's up to you. Don't be like that, Elizabeth Gilbert. Come on.
Get so anyway, until next time, that's goodbye from the filthiest podcast we ever done did.
Hey, thanks to Ryan Browning for the use of the song Destroyer. Go to sewntogetherrecords.com to download more stuff.
Enjoy it for the last time because he won't let us use it again.
Yeah. And, oh yeah, send us an email.
Yeah, definitely. Please.
Cannonfodderpod@gmail.com. Haven't gotten any lately.
Yeah, but keep it up. Keep it up.
Just so lonely. Please email us.
Follow us on Twitter, BenRWilliams@twitter.com.
That's how it works. And follow Greg at oldjawbone/angelcity/biz. And we'll see you next time, guys. Good night.
Good night, everybody.